Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We just went back in time to the Vietnam War, but let's go a bit further back in New Zealand history now. In fact, right to the beginning. In a small inlet in the Bay of Islands, clues and artefacts from the first known site of human settlement in Aotearoa are being uncovered. The site is known as Mangahawea, was first excavated in 1981. And the more bones, the obsidian and tools found at the site indicate that people first arrived here as early as 1250 in the Common Era, possibly the last landmass in the entire world, large landmass anyway, to be settled by humans. James Robinson is the Northland Regional Archaeologist for Heritage New Zealand. He's been the lead archaeologist at Mangahawea and involved with three excavations at the site. And he joins us now from our Wellington studio. James, tēnā koe. Great to have you here.
Tēnā koe, Mel. How are you doing?
Really well, thank you. Now, Mangahawea, I want you to take us there for people who haven't been to that part of the country before or this particular site. What does it look like? What does it feel like?
So Mangahawea is a bay. It's an ocean beach on the northwestern side of Moturua Island. And Moturua Island is one of the two largest islands in the Bay of Islands, along with Urapukapuka. And as you come in from the sea, it's sort of girt with cliffs on one side, and that's the thing that you would see the first as you come into the bay. So it's a subtropical paradise, as you can imagine, the most beautiful area, very sheltered waters, got good soils and marine resources. So it's an optimum area for settlement, which is why it's one of the early sites. Not the earliest site. It's one of a bunch of sites, maybe only 20 that we know of around the country from that era. And but it's remained relatively intact, which is a great value in terms of trying to understand this early period of settlement.
Is that because of the geography of the area? It's sort of preserved some things that in other parts of the country would be washed away, lost forever?
I think it's not quite. The nature of these early sites, which used to be called archaic sites, is that they occur all the way around New Zealand. These settlement sites occurred, we think, within the first living generation of those early waka coming to New Zealand. And so you have sites in the deep south and sites up north. You've got the type site, which is Wairau Bar. Mm. But they all have slightly different characteristics. And one of the characteristics that's different is that there's a horticultural zone in the north of New Zealand. And Mangahawea is one of those early sites that sits there. Mm. And what differentiates it from places like Wairau Bar is that they were never abandoned. They were continuously occupied. So the sites are still there, but often overwritten by later sites.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. And so, Mangahawea, when and how was it first identified as a significant place? This goes back many decades, I understand.
Yes, well, there used to be what was known as the Bay of Islands Maritime and Historic Park, which was under the then Lands and Survey Department. And it had historians and archaeologists working for them, including Jan Mackay. And this particular midden site, which is the sort of rubbish dump that you imagine, was seen eroding on the banks of this stream. And it happened to have some material in it that was unusual, namely cooked moa bone and a type of shellfish called Solana denticulata, both of which are a type of material which disappeared very quickly after human arrival. So finding moa bone that's cooked as opposed to sub-fossil means that the moa must have been alive, and then it was captured and killed. And so it was saying this is clearly an early site and it was starting to erode. And so the historians at the time and the archaeologists decided to do something about it. And there was an excavation led by Jan Mackay and Mr. Shepherd from Auckland University and a bunch of our senior archaeologists today who were then student archaeologists like Dave Viet and John Costa. and Mike Taylor. And all three of those have been involved in the later excavations as well.
Are there oral histories among iwi as well that suggest that, you know, this place may have, you know, a history dating back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years?
Yes, and we should probably start by saying that this was a project led by Ngāti Kuta and Patukeha under the mana of Matutera Tanana Clendon, New Zealand Order of Merit. Mm-hmm. And so Heritage New Zealand and the Universities of Otago and Auckland and Department of Conservation were there in support of this initiative, which is looking at education and knowledge. Mm. And Matu has a whakatauki that he uses that talks about these early traditions, and I'm going to read it to you.
Yeah, please.
So, rako mangamanga te tira ki Rapanui, Rapanui te tira ki Hawaii, Hawaii te tira ki Taputapu Atia, Taputapu Atia te tira ki rako mangamanga. And what that means is, Rakamangamanga, which is the hill above Rafiti in the Bay of Islands, a very distinctive one that's very visible from the sea. Mm-hmm. It represents Aotearoa, and it looks to Easter Island, which is Rapa Nui.
Yeah.
While Rapa Nui looks to Hawaii, and Hawaii looks to Tahiti, and Tahiti looks back to Rakamangamanga. So when archaeologists talk about the Polynesian Triangle, it's reflected in this traditional whakatauki. Mm.
That's beautiful. That's a lovely whakatauki.
It's a beautiful one.
Yeah. We have a segment on the show called Whakatauki of the Week, and look at that. We just got a bonus one. That's great. Actually, let's talk a bit about this. We've talked a bit about the recent history of Mangahawea, but let's turn the clock way back. We think that people arrived around 1250 Common Era. Who were these people who arrived?
Well, you know, you can go back a long way. And so one of the things you have to understand about the human settlement of our planet is that the out of Africa model had people walking out of Africa from millions of years ago, and they basically filled up the places you could walk to pretty quickly. It's the places that were separated by water and seas that slowed things down. Yeah. So, for example, the human settlement of Australia was about 70,000 years ago, and they had to get across a pretty major water gap of about 100 kilometres. But they did, and we've got evidence for that. Mm. Then you've got the settlement of North America. They had to get across from Siberia, across the Aleutian Islands, and that probably happened 20,000 to 25,000 years ago, give or take a bit. But one quarter of the world is the Pacific, and the Pacific has been it's very large, and so it took longer to get there. And so you have to go back to the to that settlement of Australia and Papua New Guinea, which, of course, was all connected because the sea levels were lower, and Torres Straits area. Mm. And then you have these islands like the Admiralties and the Bismarcks, where peoples were there for at least 30,000 years, and they were sailing around this area in Waka and making pots and things like that. Mm. And somewhere around about 3,200, 3,600 years ago, a group of these people decided to make a move, and they moved eastwards into what we call Western Polynesia. And this required them to get across about 150 kilometres of water, mm-hmm. which required better boats, yeah. and better navigation than they'd had before. But for some reason, they thought there was something out there, and the benefit was finding empty lands. And so they settled there, and we call them the Lapita people. We don't know what they're called. They're named after a village in New Caledonia where their ceramic pottery sequence was finally worked out to what it was dealing with. And so we call them that. And they went as far as Fiji and Samoa and New Hebrides at those days and New Caledonia. They settled a very large area. And their distinctive pottery is something which is known about to this day. Then it was about 1,000 years. And then people made the next big push, which is out to what we call Eastern Polynesia. Mm-hmm. And that was a 400-kilometre water gap, so you needed better boats and better navigation. And now these islands that you're going to are smaller and further apart. But it's been a very successful colonising policy, and they did so. And so somewhere around about 800 to 1200 AD, they maybe closer to 800, they moved out to what the Cook Societies, Marquesas, Tuamotos. And these are islands that if you look on Google Earth, you can't see them. They're so small.
Right.
And this became what Māori refer to as Hawaiki, or the place that I came from. Mm. And this cluster of islands tied themselves together culturally. to provide the resources to continue with this voyaging very quickly. And so from probably about 1000 AD to about 1300 AD, they had the last big push again further east, and there was like 2,400 kilometres down to Aotearoa, 3,000 kilometres out to Rapa Nui, Easter Island, and 4,000 kilometres up to Hawaii. And we know that they got further than that, that this continued. There are traditions that talk about seeing white coral or the ice, so they went as far south as they could. But we know they got to South America because we have the Kumara brought back into the Pacific, and it's been excavated from the Society Islands from around 1200 AD, which is about 100 years before, 50 to 100 years before New Zealand was settled. And it was really great that that happened, because when they got to New Zealand, they found life was quite different here. It's not tropical. It's subtropical at best and subarctic at worst.
Yeah.
And it's huge. It's 10 times larger than the rest of the island and the Pacific put together. And so the voyaging traditions mostly disappeared, and the wakas ended up being mostly single-hulled waka, except down the bottom of the South Island, where to get into the fjords, you needed ocean-going waka, and that's what Lieutenant Cook reported in 1769. And so they arrive here, and they're getting really, really good at voyaging and settling and working out what to do. And in many ways, it's exactly like what Cook did with all those scientists on board. They were out exploring, finding what's there, trying to work out the problems and the opportunities, and sometimes how to make a problem into an opportunity. And we know that they settled around the whole of New Zealand very, very quickly, and they found all the stone sources and all the marine resources and things very, very quickly. Archaeologists recognize the sites in the deep south of New Zealand, especially on the west coast and the east coast of the South Island, because it's relatively simple archaeology. You had a period when no humans were here. Then you had Polynesian arrivals, and you get these big moa hunting sites like Wairoa. And then for a period of time, once that resource was gone, they were abandoned because you can't live on fish. And it's only later that people move back in. So you get this lovely sequencing, which is very easy to see. But up in the north, above this sort of horticultural barrier line, which runs sort of somewhere between Banks Peninsula and the sort of Wairarapa in a sort of wiggly line, and it moves up and down a bit as climate changes, is where you find most of the population, you find most of the archaeology, and it's all because it's horticultural based. And horticultural provides the economic powerhouse for these people who were small-scale gardeners and hunters when they arrived. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, you can clearly see that in the early stories about Māori as were reported by various explorers.
That was a great history. You condensed many hundreds of years of history into just a couple of minutes there. Thanks for that. I'm speaking to James Robinson about Mangahawea. James is the Northland Regional Archaeologist for Heritage New Zealand. Now, let's talk about Mangahawea and what you have unearthed during the time of excavating this era. What actually is preserved there physically?
So it's a fluvial terrace, which means it's sort of a raised terrace. So it seems to have survived really well. So you've got this big flat terrace, but sort of in a bay, so you've got two headlands on each side. Out at one of the headlands, there's two little islands, Motu Oi, Oi being the mutton birding, and Motu Raiatea, which is one of those ancestral names that dates back to Raiatea, which occurs in multiple places in the Hawaiki Eastern Pacific, including Tahiti and including the Cooks. And so you have this lovely sheltered beach that looks into the bay, and what we find is that it basically separates into two zones. One is a gardening zone, and one is the occupation zone. The occupation zone sort of occupies the strip above the high tide line, probably 10 to 15 metres wide, and it breaks in a couple of places. But most of the volume of the area is to do with horticulture. And so the occupation area has intact stratigraphy that includes all the way back to that sort of circa 1300, maybe late 1200s, with features such as giant hangis, lots of cooking, lots of artifacts, lots of fish hooks, moa bone and seal bone fish hooks, artifacts that are of what we call Polynesian design but made from New Zealand black lip power. So an example of early adaptation to this new environment. And then it continues, the occupation there continues into the historic period with a lot of historic material, but it's still a Maori settlement all the way through, just making use of European material. So it's got this continuity, which is difficult to see in New Zealand archaeology because people have large territories and they move around a lot and redo things. But you must understand that it's not so much the bay, it's the island that's the early settlement. You can walk around the island in less than an hour. Mm. You know, there's no reason to, everyone just lived at this bay. They all did different things. The other side of the island is what's known as Camp Bay, which is where the World War II army camp was. And there is, again, cooked marbone eroding out of those banks. On the southeastern side, excavations there have found, again, very, very early settlement. So this island is a classic place to settle in the bay. And the thing about the bay is that because it's sheltered and because you've got good waterways, you can use waka to connect things together. You have quite a large territory. Mm-hmm. And it was very popular. I mean, Cook talks about 2,000 people coming out to meet him when he came into the bay and things like that. So it was very deeply settled. So then you've got the gardens, and those we think we've found evidences of taro growing on the edge of a filled-in stream, mm-hmm. but also clear evidence of kumara production in what they call puke zones, just like you get in the Wairarapa with Warren Gumley, an archaeologist down that way, has found this quincunx pattern of these, basically making a sort of a little bowl shape with material in this case beach material, because one of the things kumara really needs when it grows is a nice hard base to make the tubers stop growing down and start bulking out with carbs.
James, this is fascinating. We're almost out of time. We've only got about 40 to 45 seconds left. I'll just ask you this in sort of summary. Fascinating to hear you talk about this and all of the discoveries there. And as an archaeologist, but also as a New Zealander, what does it feel like when you are standing there on 800 years of history?
This is a place where you can actually start asking questions about how and why people move around the world, because it's so recent. We still have the traditional knowledge. We're lucky to be able to tie that traditional knowledge together with the European sciences to actually have a chance to asking questions that colleagues around the world have less of a chance because their history is so much longer.
James Robinson, absolutely fascinating. Have you ever written any books about this, James? The texter has asked me this.
I'm writing a final report on the archaeology as we speak. Yeah. There is an article that came out with Professor Richard Walter and myself and a few other authors in 2017 about the 2017 excavation.
Great stuff.
But, yeah.
James Robinson, a real delight chatting to you this evening. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.